Cyber Incident Response.
Introduction. Before anyone touches it, a stone is just a stone. But when it's lifted and placed within a larger structure, like a winding country wall, it becomes a barrier, a landmark, a work of art. And when it's picked up and used to strike someone else, it changes into a weapon capable of causing harm or even death. Like the quiet stone, technology is neutral. It's an extension of human capability and one of the greatest tools in civilization. Both the simple rock and the not-so-simple devices can bring about our oppression or our liberation. The outcome depends on how we, as humans, use them. Computers have long been used to commit crimes. However, thanks to a growing field known as computer forensics, they are now being actively used to fight them. This evidence-gathering process empowers authorities to learn more about cybercrimes, how they can be investigated, and the ways online attackers can be held accountable for their actions. And surprisingly, it has also become a reliable part of fighting crime in the real world. Responding to cyber incidents. Just as a real-life crisis can leave you feeling shaken and afraid, a powerful digital attack on your privacy can cause a major disruption to your confidence, trust, and livelihood. Being violated by an outside force is never a good feeling, and the only thing that makes it worse is having no plan of recourse or support. That's why developing a proper incident response plan, IRP, with clear details and instructions is essential to a strong and effective security strategy. An IRP is an organized and already established approach to handling the fallout of a security breach or attack. Without one, the overall cost of the losses could become considerably worse. The goal of an effective IRP is to handle troubling situations in a way that limits overall damage and reduces recovery time and costs. When developing an IRP, it's important to define exactly what different words mean when describing a breach in security. Even among those in the field, there is sometimes confusion around what constitutes an event, an alert, or an incident. But these terms are leveled in such a way that they build upon one another. A computer event relates to something happening in the normal behavior of a system, process, or environment. This action or occurrence is not necessarily bad. It can refer to something as simple as a user clicking a mouse or pressing a key, and is tracked by a routine known as an event handler. Larger events include a web browser loading, a file being created, or the arrival of incoming network traffic. A computer alert is a notification that a particular event or series of events has occurred. This message is then sent to the party responsible for starting the action or to the user who will benefit from the information. You might receive an alert when your device has an available software update or when you have signed into your device from a new location. A computer incident is typically a malicious event caused by any kind of disruption, leading to a disruption of services. This is defined a little differently based on the rules of the organization. However, it will always warrant special attention and require a timely response. Some incidents, however, are not intentional, but are the product of human error or even natural disaster. In this way, an attack on your computer could utilize an event to create an incident, which is then reported through an alert. Incident response steps. The IRP of an organization is usually conducted through a special cyber incident response team, CIRT, made up of people who fully understand IT issues, internet legalities, and the unique resources of the company. Within this effort, there are six basic steps for the efficient handling of an incident. Preparation. Always be ready. Any good IT staff has applied updated security on all technology and is trained to respond to incidents quickly and effectively. Identification. Know what you are dealing with. Because not all incidents are malicious, a response team must properly assess the situation and determine the severity of the problem. How big has the issue become? How far has it reached? And how many systems and devices are affected? Containment. Get control of the situation. The team must quickly come up with a plan of action. Depending on the seriousness of the issue, they will need to take steps to contain the problem. Although there are many strategies for containment, one example could include disconnecting all affected systems and devices, thereby minimizing the damage. Eradication. Get rid of the problem. In order to do this, the team must discover the incident's origin. Once the root has been traced and determined, the malware or cause of the problem can be eradicated. Recovery. Get back what you can. Fortunately, there are often ways to restore data from backups. This important piece can be credited to a solid preparation step. Lessons learned. Understand what happened. How was the problem handled? The team must consider if they were happy with the larger response and make any recommendations to improve future action. Know the signs of infection. When your computer becomes infected by malware, it demonstrates some specific signs like lag, pop-ups, crashes, and strange actions, but it will typically put up some kind of alert as well. If you have ever wandered into a questionable area of the internet and been faced with a warning sign that you should head back to safety, you're likely familiar with what this looks like. And sometimes, knowing your device has been compromised is just a gut feeling. When it comes to your personal security, always err on the side of caution and act quickly. You likely know your computer pretty well and can identify when something out of the ordinary is happening. Some warning signs that your device has been compromised. Additional toolbars appear in your browser. Your usual password is not granting you access. Extra browser screens pop up without your request. There have been unauthorized changes to file contents. Your printer is malfunctioning and not following commands. People in your contact list are receiving fake emails from you. Your standard programs and files won't open or work properly. Your internet searches are being redirected without permission. New programs appear on your computer that you did not install. Your mouse cursor is moving around the screen without your direction. Files you did not delete begin to disappear or have been placed in the trash. Your computer is automatically connecting to the internet while it's not in use. Money is missing from your bank account, or you are receiving bills for online purchases you did not make. While these symptoms vary in severity, they can all be indications of a serious breach, and in such an event, you will need to take quick action to minimize the damage and the threat. But let's face it, not all of us have our own personal incident response team, so when something goes wrong with our personal devices, what can we do about it? First, stay calm and think about what is happening and what you can do in line with the 6 steps for incident response. Keeping a quick list of instructions nearby to consult in a moment of panic may make you feel more confident. What is computer forensics? Criminal investigators use scientific processes to look for evidence, and when this evidence is electronic, in the form of flash drives, smartphones, digital cameras, or hard drives, it's referred to as digital forensics, cyber forensics, or computer forensics, CF. The practice of CF collects, analyzes, and safeguards digital data involved in a security breach, as well as reports on any evidence it finds. When an attack, exploit, or general incident occurs on a device, certain details must be documented and examined, just like a real-life crime. Regardless of whether the incident relates to a homicide or a cyber attack, specific tests or techniques must be used to unravel the crime through a combination of science, technology, and investigation. The chain of evidence gathered through this process is extremely important because it may need to be presented in a legal setting where guilt can be determined. The principle of exchange. Any action of an individual, and obviously the violent action constituting a crime, cannot occur without leaving a trace. Edmund Locard, 1877 to 1966. Before we go any further into the notion of criminal or cyber forensics, let's explore the fundamental idea of exchange. Long gone are the days when someone committed a crime and simply ran away, likely never to be identified. Nowadays, there are endless ways to connect a perpetrator to an incident, even if there were no witnesses, through physical evidence. In the early 20th century, a doctor named Edmund Locard developed a concept about how people are always exchanging physical materials anytime they come into contact with another person, place, or thing. If you touch a table, you leave a fingerprint. If you set foot on a sandy beach, you leave a footprint. If you kiss someone on the cheek, you leave a trace of saliva on their skin, and so on. No matter where criminals go or what they do, they leave behind a trail of evidence in the form of DNA, body fluids, fibers, skin cells, and more. And through this contact, criminals also take certain things away from the scene as well. Often referred to as trace evidence, these signatures are based on fact, not suspicion or theory, and do not lie. It then becomes essential for a crime scene investigator to recognize, document, and collect this evidence from the scene or from anyone who may have been present. Once the evidence is gathered, it then becomes a piece that must be assembled to form a larger picture of the crime. While this fundamental theory of exchange was first applied to crimes of humanity, its basic principles can also be applied to technology and the investigation of cybercrime. When computers, networks, servers, and software share information and make contact in various ways, they too leave behind certain signatures and bits of evidence in the form of data. Following these virtual clues can therefore be achieved in much the same way as a real-world forensic study. Similar to other police work, forensic investigators usually follow a set procedure when tracking the trail of an incident as a means of accountability and efficiency. Both the National Institute of Standards and Technology, NIST, and the SANS Institute share principles on how to approach this investigatory process. While much of what they do resembles CERT efforts, their process tends to be far more extensive and focuses not just on recovery and learning, but on establishing the exact method and identity of the perpetrator.
Did you know? According to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, computer forensic jobs in the United States will increase by 28% between 2016 and 2026. That means more than 28,000 new jobs will be available. With a median salary around $95,000, not to mention challenging yet rewarding work, a career in computer forensics looks very appealing.
Principles of investigation. Step 1. The first step in the investigatory process is verification. Here, the nature of the case is assessed, and authorities figure out the breadth and scope of the incident. They also determine how the evidence should be identified, collected, and preserved. Part of the verification process is to write a system description, a step-by-step illustration of what the breached system does and how it factors into the overall organization. This can include outlining the configuration of the OS and the location of the evidence. In this way, the investigator becomes more familiar with the tools, or weapons, related to the crime. Step 2. Next, forensic investigators track the journey of the data, capturing all of it, and examining which of it is posing the threat. Just like authorities at a crime scene, taking too much evidence is never much of a concern. It's not always clear right away what data is malicious, so taking more rather than less back for analysis is better. Prioritizing and securing cyber evidence as quickly as possible is extremely important, as it is volatile and can change over time. For example, a confiscated smartphone could be wiped of incriminating data through a remote command. Once the most troubling data is collected, the investigator can move on to sweeping up the non-volatile data, like the hard drive. Working with problematic data should always be done on a non-infected system and with an approved forensic toolkit that can reboot the system. Step 3. Once the evidence is collected, it can be closely scrutinized to create a timeline analysis of what happened and when. This data is gathered using a variety of tools and is extracted from the metadata layer of the file system and then sorted in a manageable way. This analysis generates a snapshot of the activity within the system, including the source. Step 4. With a timeline in place, the investigators then focus on media and artifact analysis, where they seek to determine which data has direct bearing on the case. Although situations vary, some typical answers found in this process revolve around what programs were executed, which files were downloaded and clicked on, which directories were opened, and what files were deleted. Browser history is also reviewed. By identifying upfront which files are corrupted and which are not, the data pool is reduced considerably. Step 5. Once any usable data is recovered, the final phase involves communicating all the findings to the organization who suffered the attack. During this time of reporting results, recommendations can be made for improving policies, guidelines, procedures, tools, and other protocols. Computer forensics investigations. In the early days, digital forensics focused mostly on computer crime, but it has since become a valuable tool in solving all sorts of crimes, cyber and otherwise. As a result, law enforcement agencies are continually incorporating CF into their day-to-day methods and utilizing their findings in different ways. But advanced training in this area is still not part of the core education for most police academies, which means the practice of collecting digital evidence is still a work in progress. Just like real-world evidence, anything found in the digital sphere must be reliable, authentic, and admissible, which means a certain chain of custody or the documentation of a process to certify that evidence under investigation has not been tampered with must be observed if the evidence is to be used in the conviction of a cybercrime. It must be discovered, stored, handled, and documented in just the right way so it adheres to all legal expectations. If it doesn't, the integrity of the evidence can be compromised, and guilty people can easily walk free. Understanding the rules around CF can be challenging when the laws written before the era of computers are not able to effectively cover the techniques required in a computer system search. One of the biggest challenges of CF is to keep society's laws up to speed with technological advancement. If you think about a smartphone, or any device for that matter, as a closed container, the legal boundaries surrounding it are easier to understand. Just as investigators must observe certain guidelines when digging through someone's room or even their purse, they must respect the privacy of a person's device. And when they do have permission to go through someone's digital data, the methods of extraction are different from those of physical evidence. Because data lives and hides in various electronic forms, the challenge to pull it free from its device, program, or drive can require a few techniques. One such method is known as file carving, which allows for users to recover digital information without using the help of metadata or other guidance. File carving software uses markers like headers and footers to identify parts of a file, in addition to special algorithms designed to improve file recovery. Touchscreens and keyboards can be used to manually locate information, while logical extractions may use external computer equipment to communicate with the device in code. Because digital data is often embedded in other networks, finding its location can be like trying to locate a star in a larger constellation of IT systems. Some of these spheres where the evidence lives may be beyond the reach of law enforcement because they rub up against the privacy of others and our ideas of a person's legal rights and freedoms. Hot news in cyber forensics. One notable example of how CF has forged new territory in the world of privacy happened in 2015, when Apple refused to help the FBI open a smartphone involved in the mass shooting in San Bernardino, California, that left 14 people dead and 22 others injured. The authorities chased down two suspects as they fled from the scene, eventually killing them in a shootout. Because the perpetrators were dead, they could not be questioned about the crime or who may have helped them, but they did leave behind an iPhone 5C, and the FBI quickly determined it could likely offer some key evidence in the case. The only problem was, no one knew the passcode, and too many wrong guesses could cause the digital data to be deleted. The FBI requested the help of Apple, who refused to unencrypt the device, saying that doing so would set a dangerous precedent. Encryption is set up to protect the user, and breaching that privacy in one case would likely open the floodgates for many more requests in the future. Both sides believed firmly in their stance, but just one day before the hearing was set to take place, a private hacker successfully opened the phone for the FBI without involving Apple, and so the case was never really settled, and the area remains decidedly gray. As methods for encryption and anonymity grow more advanced, how do we differentiate between a safe haven for criminals and the right to privacy? Digital investigations. Let's take a moment to consider exactly how digital data might be used to convict someone of a real-life crime. The case of the BTK killer offers one of the most famous instances of how CF cracked the case of a terrifying murderer. For over 30 years, police tried to use traditional evidence to track down a man who had apparently bound, tortured, and then killed 10 people, mostly women, from 1974 to 1991 in Kansas. His murder methods became his acronym, Bind, Torture, Kill. Although the killer sometimes sent the authorities taunting letters and poems, no one could uncover his identity. Technology evolved during the BTK killer's 16-year crime spree, so he updated his communication method as well, eventually sending the police a floppy disk containing a Microsoft Word document in 2004. In just a few hours, authorities were able to uncover metadata on the disk that linked the disk's last use to a church and listed the last person to modify it as being named Dennis. This evidence finally uncovered the identity of Dennis Rader, who pled guilty and was ordered to serve 10 life sentences in prison. You might be thinking that the era of floppy disks has passed, but the era of metadata has not. Something as simple as a smartphone can tell investigators many things about the person who owns it, including where the person has been in recent days. By tracking the last known cell towers pinged by the phone, authorities can learn a lot about a person's movements. Similarly, satellite navigation systems, car radios, and even social media check-ins can share a person's location at any given time. By gaining a subpoena and legal permission to access a device, investigators can collect all sorts of history and information about the owner. Even if it doesn't directly prove anything, this type of information can be used to confirm a hunch or lead to new information. Any emails, texts, instant messages, transactions, images, or internet histories are all examples of information that can be gathered and used effectively as evidence. And because the cloud system provides a way to store and access thousands of past communications and pictures, digital evidence can provide considerable scope and sequence to any investigation. Remember, even when digital information is deleted, it's typically not entirely gone. What's in the bag? To illustrate how CF is upping its evidence game, let's look at one of its niftiest tools, the Faraday bag. Because digital data is volatile and subject to deletion or manipulation, authorities are always looking for new ways to secure important information from the moment it's seized to the moment it is presented in court as evidence. Because it's made with materials able to block wireless signals, the Faraday bag makes the perfect storage place for devices under investigation. While it can't prevent the device from internal functions, the Faraday bag can block remote access, making it impossible for hackers to destroy the information they might have left behind. Sometimes, law enforcement has to work hard to identify possible sources of digital evidence. Flash drives in the form of teddy bears, dolls, and even stylish jewelry can make digital detection difficult, while virtual machines and network-attached storage systems running on a separate OS can make it even harder. That's why investigators using CF have had to work hard to create innovative, new ways to sniff out electronic devices, sometimes literally. In the case of Bear, the canine electronic sniffing dog, finding hidden electronics is just part of the job. Not only can the Black Labrador Retriever detect everything from thumb drives to cell phones, he can even find tiny micro SD cards holding several gigabytes of data with his nose. In a field often dominated by high-tech solutions, Bear is a reminder that the digital world can still be affected by the natural one. Anti-computer forensics. Knowing that there are black hat and white hat hackers, it shouldn't come as a surprise that there is also a field known as counter-forensics or anti-computer forensics. These anti-efforts attempt to ruin and negate any electronic evidence that may exist, making it the natural enemy of crime-solving CF. Although the process of protecting one's privacy and personal data is sometimes classified as counter-forensics, the term is largely applied to hiding data, wiping drives clean, or covering an electronic trail. Sometimes these efforts go so far as to directly attack existing forensics tools to leave them ineffective. While some people feel anti-forensics is mostly used by people hoping to avoid arrest, others view the practice as a great learning opportunity for law enforcement, since anti-forensics work highlights the weaknesses of the existing system. In this way, investigators and researchers can use these findings to strengthen the work of CF by building better forensic tools, procedures, and training. Because hackers are highly capable tech experts, they come up with very inventive ways to hinder the process of law enforcement. Let's look at some of the more well-known ones. Methods for hindering law enforcement. Data hiding. The process of data hiding tries to make information hard to find, but easy to retrieve. People who use data hiding as a method of concealment are typically trying to bog down a forensic investigation. If you can't find it, you can't use it. Encryption. Encryption can be a nightmare for forensic experts because it allows the user to create virtual bits of information that are only accessible with a special key. Through the use of algorithms and other techniques, These programs can make data impossible to access. And even worse for investigators, anti-forensic software is now widely available to anyone looking to avoid detection. Steganography. Whereas encryption makes data unreadable to a third party, steganography is the science of hiding information or files within another file to keep them away from that same third party. More traditional methods might use invisible ink to hide secret messages, but the more sophisticated ones of today could enable a user to hide large amounts of information within an image or file. These methods are often used together with encryption, so a user must find the well-hidden information and then try to figure out what it means. Trail obfuscation. Criminals have been trying to cover their tracks forever, and anti-forensics is just following suit. The process of trail obfuscation seeks to confuse or divert a forensic examination so it loses the trail of the criminal. It uses tools like log cleaners, spoofing, Trojan commands, and zombied accounts to send investigators off in useless directions. By modifying metadata related to access, creation, and times and dates, a cybercriminal may not escape entirely, but they can call into question the credibility of any collected evidence. Direct attacks on forensic tools. Just as it sounds, this approach doesn't seek to hide or muddle information. It goes straight for the throat by creating tools capable of attacking forensic efforts. For example, if a forensic examination created a hash function to preserve the integrity of an image, an anti-tool might target that process by messing with the hash and placing doubt on the entire investigation. Even though anti-forensic efforts are on the rise, investigators and experts can reduce their vulnerability to these weaknesses by improving various training methods, working together to verify results, and inventing new ways to stay ahead of cybercriminals.
Knowledge check. Test your knowledge of new information by answering these questions and then review the feedback. Question 1. A large accounting firm has just come under a ransomware attack. Dozens of their computers have been locked until the ransom is paid. The cybersecurity team has been frantically working to disconnect all computers from the network until the source of the ransomware has been located. What step in the Incident Response Plan, IRP, has the team just implemented? Identification. Because the cybersecurity team already knows that the incident involves ransomware, they are past the identification stage. Consider a stage that involves trying to limit the infected computers. Containment. The issue has already been identified, and the team is currently trying to contain the incident by isolating all computers from the network. Eradication. Because the team does not yet know the source of the ransomware attack, they cannot begin eradicating the threat. Consider a stage that involves trying to limit the infected computers. Recovery. Because the threat has not been pinpointed or eradicated, recovery cannot yet begin. Consider a stage that involves trying to limit the infected computers. Question 2. A computer forensic specialist just received permission from the courts to examine the data on a suspect's laptop. When the specialist logs into the computer, he notices that the file system does not have any file names, dates, or folders. The data is all jumbled up. He gets to work using a tool that allows him to find and analyze headers and footers in order to identify the specific files. What process is the specialist most likely using? File carving. File carving involves recovering data when no file system metadata, such as names, dates, and folders, is present. The specialist can identify distinct files through the header and footer markers. Stonewalling. Stonewalling is a term that refers to delaying or disrupting a process. It does not apply to this computer forensic situation. Consider an option that involves recovering files without the use of file system metadata. Media and artifact analysis. Media and artifact analysis refers to the process of determining which data is relevant for a case. The specialist needs to have access to the data before the analysis can happen, so consider an option that involves recovering files first. System description. A system description is written when a system has been breached, with the purpose of familiarizing the investigator with the tools related to the crime. Consider an option that involves recovering files without the use of file system metadata. Question 3. A criminal sends sensitive information to an associate, but embeds the data in an image attached to an email. What is the term for this process? Trail obfuscation. Trail obfuscation refers to the process of using tools to divert an investigation to a useless direction. Consider an option that hides files within other files. Steganography. Steganography is the science of hiding files within other files, and that is exactly what the criminal has done in this scenario. Encryption. Encryption involves using private keys to make data unreadable to anybody besides the keyholder. There is no evidence of encryption being used in this scenario. Consider an option that hides files within other files. Faraday bag. A Faraday bag is used to store devices in order to protect them from interference from other devices, usually to protect court evidence. Consider an option that hides files within other files.
Conclusion. There's no doubt, the world of cybersecurity is a vast and complicated one. Not only does it concern itself with tiny pieces of code and data, but it has a direct relationship with the larger, real-world land of crime. As humans continue to use and depend on technology for daily life, issues around digital forensics will grow and change. The forces of good continue to push against the forces of ill, and in that way, forensics is a constantly shifting and developing field. Which side will come out on top is up to us.